I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Michael Lewis has a talent for turning esoteric, i.e. boring topics on things like bond sales and baseball statistics and collateralized debt obligations into bestsellers. Exhibit A, Moneyball, and The Big Short, which were both turned into popular movies. His new book, The Undoing Project, is about the intense and unlikely friendship, really the intellectual love affair between two Israeli psychologists, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. They did groundbreaking research on decision-making and how the human mind works and doesn't work in uncertain, stressful situations. A few years ago, President Obama gave Kahneman the Medal of Freedom. Here's a clip of what the president said.
Now, all of us have moments when we look back and wonder, what the heck was I thinking? I have that quite a bit. Psychologist Daniel Kahneman has made that simple question his life's work. In a storied career in Israel and America, he basically invented the study of human decision-making. He's helped us to understand everything from behavioral economics to does living in California make people happy? It's an interesting question. He's also been called an expert on irrational behavior, so I'm sure that he could shed some light on Washington.
Michael Lewis joins us at WHYY's Hamilton Media Commons with a sold-out audience of WHYY donors and supporters. Give your hands, give yourself a big round of applause and to Michael Lewis as well.
Thank you.
So, Michael, what is the path that led from Liar's Poker through all the other books that you have written to this one, The Undoing Project?
We could fill the hour with that.
We could.
Do not want to do that.
No, we don't.
But I tell you, why don't I tell you the path from the one book to this? Because Moneyball led to this. So Moneyball was a story about the Oakland A's, in particular how the Oakland A's had built winning teams with no money. And at the heart of that story, the reason that story got written, my interest in it, was the question of why baseball experts misvalue baseball players. That's what the Oakland A's were finding, these bargains in the marketplace. How was it? And they also finding players that were overvalued. How is it that the baseball experts got so wrong, the value of baseball players, when what they do on the job is the same thing they've done for 100 years? There are statistics attached to their every move. Millions of people watch them on the job. If those people can be misvalued, who can't be, was sort of at the bottom of that. When the book came out, there was a review by an economist named Richard Thaler, together with a legal scholar named Cass Sunstein. And they said, you know, this is a nice story, but the author doesn't seem to realize that the mechanisms in the human mind that are causing these players to be misvalued, which totally explored, and this book, in a funny way, was totally anticipated and described by two Israeli psychologists, Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman, working in the 70s at Hebrew University. Kahneman had won the Nobel Prize in economics for this work, even though he wasn't an economist, he was a psychologist. And I thought, oh my God, I missed the story. You know, I kind of buried it because I hope nobody noticed. But I hadn't thought to ask. Like, okay, this is going on. It is interesting that people get misvalued for all sorts of reasons. But I hadn't asked, what's going on? Why? You know, why? I just took it as a given that we had these kind of biases. Well, biases is their word. As it's used there. It took me a few years. May I go on, or am I boring you? I'm looking at your eyes.
You're not boring me, right. Just quickly, because I have a couple of questions about these two men.
It took a few years, and then I realized that Danny Kahneman lived up the hill from me in Berkeley, California.
Wow.
And that's the beginning of the story.
Well, what's interesting is this is not just a working relationship or even a friendship. You really describe that this is a love affair between two men, not a sexual love affair, but an intense intellectual love affair. You have scenes of people seeing them together. They're either arguing or just laughing their heads off. What was at the root of this friendship, this love?
You know, it's funny. They're two very heterosexual men. The passion between them leads me to question the importance of sex and love. Yes. I mean, it was extraordinary. They were clearly the most important relationship in each other's lives. on Amos's deathbed, he turned to Danny and he said, "You know, no person on earth has caused me as much pain as you've caused me." And Danny, to a dying man, almost said that back. And
they were married, we should say.
They were both married. The wives were very aware that this relationship dominated their imaginations. And it was the relationship that got me hooked in the first place, because I went up to see Danny and just have him explain to me how much I missed. I didn't think I was going to write a book about him. And we started taking these walks in the Berkeley Hills, and he would just talk about his feelings for this man who had died 20 years ago and how their collaboration had worked and some of the ideas. And I thought, oh, my God, right, that you don't connect this sort of intellectual activity with high emotion. And if you talk to other academics, they say this just doesn't really happen. And, you know, people collaborate all the time. This business of finishing each other's sentences, of sitting side by side while they wrote sentence by sentence like they're brushing each other's teeth, and the drama of the ending, that they break up like lovers, that you just don't see this. And I thought that's what hooked me in the first place.
Well, each of them so interesting and so different in their own right. Danny Kahneman, as a young child, was hiding from and running from the Nazis in France. Amos seemed like a guy who had all the confidence in the world, kind of did whatever he wanted to do, one a pessimist, one an optimist. Was it their oppositeness that drew them together? They sort of completed each other?
Well, you know, there is a kind of Jerry Maguire feel to it, yes. But I think one of the keys to the relationship was each found in the other something they wished they had in themselves. Right. Danny, Amos Tversky was, by just all accounts, the smartest man anybody had ever met, without being, you know, self-conscious about it. He was kind of a natural guy, funny, kooky, dude, all kind. But when someone designed a one-line intelligence test, and it was, after you've met Amos, the longer it takes you to figure out that Amos is smarter than you, the stupider you are.
And
no one who knew Amos disputed that. Amos went, I have stories of Amos. He went to a party filled with some of the best physicists in the world. It was supposed to be all physicists. It was all chit-chat. It was a cocktail party. After the party, one of the bright young physicists called the hostess and said, "Who was that physicist I was cornered by?" And they couldn't figure out who he was talking to. And they said, no, that wasn't a physicist. That was Amos Tversky. He's a psychologist. Wow. And the physicist said, "That was the smartest physicist I've ever met." and so you're talking about a very unusual mind, powerful, clear mind. Danny's mind, but Amos, as a child, he wanted to be a poet or a novelist.
Interesting.
He had strong artistic kind of impulses that he did not have the gift. He didn't have the imaginative gifts to kind of pursue. And Danny, on the other hand, is this, he's a novelistic imagination. His imagination is so vivid. His fantasy life is so vivid when he's hiding in chicken coops and barns in southern France during World War II that he realizes he has to, even into adulthood, he has to be careful about what he fantasizes about, because the experience is so vivid, it's as if he's lived it or had it. So he doesn't allow himself to fantasize about things he might have to strive to obtain, because it reduces his motivational level because he's already experienced it. But Danny has this quixotic idea that he's a scientist, and he does force himself into this science, psychology. But what Danny did not have is the power to see his thoughts as clearly as they needed to be seen to be of value to the outside world. And Amos was able to do that.
It's interesting that they both ended up living in Israel. Obviously, Danny goes there as a younger person.
As a refugee.
As a refugee, exactly. And they both serve in the military. How much do you think living in Israel and even serving in the military helped their thinking about decision-making?
It's central to the story. The backdrop of this story is, and this was another reason I was kind of hooked by it, it's not two pointy-headed intellectuals who are removed from life. They're every few years they're required to go off and shoot at people and get shot at. And in fact, and the effect of this on their work is so, and their lives is so bracing. It made me think that this might be good for all professors.
To go out and fight somewhere.
Shoot at somebody and get shot at every few years. It would be. I think it would inform their work in various ways. But Israel forced them in a very combination of Israel and the fact of being a Jew, especially on the back end of the Holocaust. The effects of this are, I think, as follows. One. We're all kind of interested in uncertainty and how people make judgments and decisions in conditions of uncertainty. But I think you get a little more interested in it when you think your whole society might depend on the quality of your judgment. It's an existential thing. If your leaders are systematically misjudging things around them, horrible things might happen. Danny's father misjudged Hitler. They had every opportunity to very comfortably move to Israel before the war in France. And he said, no, what happened in, I saw this, I've seen this movie before in World War I, and nothing bad happens. It's a war, but we're fine, and all this talk about, we're hearing about Jews, it's not to be taken seriously. So you've got that. Secondly, the Israeli life, especially in the early Israeli state, forced these people to be improvisational and practical. So Danny Kahneman, who in a different, you know, in another path, if the World War II had not happened and he'd been French and remained in France, he'd have been an ethereal French intellectual who had nothing to do with the world around him. Israel forced him into the army, and the status was being helpful. And he was, at age 22, self-taught, basically, as a psychologist. And he was the only one in the army with psychological training, even though he'd given it to himself. And they said, we have a psychology problem for you. The army was a mess. There were failures in leadership, basically. The wrong people were being put in leadership positions, I think is the gist of it. And they said, how do we choose our leaders better? 22-year-old says, designs Moneyball for the Israeli military.
Wow.
He says, the problem is you're using the judgment of these scouts, these experts about who's going to be a good officer, to stick people in positions. I'll build an algorithm. I'll figure out what the traits are that are important in an officer, and we'll measure those traits in people, and that we'll allocate people that way. Danny and I visited the Israeli Army headquarters together in 2009. They use the algorithm now.
Wow.
The United States, the Pentagon, called the head of the Israeli psychology unit in the early 80s and hauled him into the Pentagon to talk to all the generals. And they said, you use the same rifles, you have the same tanks, you have the same airplanes. How come you're so much more successful than we are on the battlefield? We think it's the psychology. Tell me what this guy did. So they did this when he was 22 as kind of a, so you ask how Israel informs them. They have a sense that the work they're doing could be extremely important.
And we're almost up in a break here. Could one of the lessons of these two psychologists be suspicious of what experts have to say?
Oh, that's definitely one of the lessons.
We will pick up on that after this very short break. I'm Marty Moskow-Wang talking with Michael Lewis about his new book. It is called The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. And we are here with a room full of WHYY supporters and donors talking about Michael's new book. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get right back. Stay with us. I do want to play a scene from Moneyball featuring Jonah Hill and Brad Pitt about how Oakland A's general manager Billy Beane used stats to evaluate players. Let's give it a listen.
What's this?
This is the code that I've written for our year-to-year projections. This is building in all the intelligence that we have to project players.
Okay.
It's about getting things down to one number. Using stats the way we read them, we'll find value in players that nobody else can see. People are overlooked for a variety of biased reasons and perceived flaws. Age, appearance, personality. Bill James and mathematics cut straight through that. Billy, of the 20,000 notable players for us to consider, I believe that there is a championship team of 25 people that we could afford, because everyone else in baseball undervalues them. Like an island of misfit toys.
And, of course, Moneyball, based on our guest book, Michael Lewis. This is a special edition of Radio Times. We're at WHYY's Hamilton Media Commons with a room full of WHYY donors and supporters, and Michael Lewis talking about his new book, The Undoing Project. And, again, it's about the groundbreaking work of two Israeli psychologists, Daniel Kahneman, Amos Tversky, their contributions to our understanding of human decision-making that has influenced economics and other fields as well. Let me go back to these two men, these two psychologists. What is the, I hate to ask this, what is the soundbite description of what they came up with? Is that possible? Because they cover so many different
parts. I'll try to do it in a sentence or two.
Okay.
They made us all aware that fallibility is a part of us, that we are our minds are inherently fallible, systematically prone to make certain kinds of mistakes. And there's nothing much we can do about it except be aware of it and find ways to kind of check ourselves.
And we did not know that?
No.
That we are prone to make mistakes?
We knew we were people. So obviously people didn't think people were perfectly rational all the time. But before they come on the scene, the state of the, at least in academia, the understanding of the human mind and where it worked was, yeah, there are emotional states that mislead you. But when you're in a calm, rational state, the mistakes people make are kind of random and unsystematic. So they kind of cancel each other out in the marketplace. Their point was there's systematic error that you can and predictable error. And when you have systematic error, you got a different kind of problem. You have markets can go wrong. Elections can go wrong. So on and so forth. And they showed that rather than a generally kind of receive review, that people were, they weren't doing statistical calculations when they made judgments that were inherently probabilistic, but they might as well have been. They got to that kind of answer. And they showed, no, people are doing something entirely different. And they explored what they did. What they did was tell stories.
Yeah.
The question is how those stories get told.
And they also asked questions. And as someone who does that for a living, I mean, they asked very important and kind of basic questions to people.
Yes, they did. The research they did, the research program was as inventive as the ideas that were kind of underneath it. These kind of work better on the page than on the radio, so I don't want to make my book seem even more boring than it is.
But you're doing fine, so just so you know.
But they would say they had one of their avenues of inquiry was how memory, what is easily recalled to mind, distorts your judgment of likelihood. And the way they how do you test it? It's not easy to design a test that you can use to reveal this or to explore this hypothesis. They gave people a passage of prose that was 2,000 words long, and there's several letters in the English language that appear more frequently in the third position in a word than in the first. V, K, I can't remember all four of them, but they'd say, for example, after the person read the passage, how many instances are there of words that start with K?
Hmm.
And they'd ask them to estimate the number. And how many instances, without going back and looking at it, how many instances are there of words that had K in the third position? Well, everybody can remember kind of some of the words that start with K because they're easier to remember. Nobody thinks of K in the third position. People would estimate, that K appeared in the first letter three times more. And it was the reverse kind of thing. So little things like that. But the tests, in a way, you find yourself, you read the little word problems they gave people, you fall for that, you make the mistake, and the experience is similar to when you see an optical illusion, and then someone points it out. And you realize you have this kind of cognitive illusion in your head, and that it has great, instantly, you kind of think, what's the applicability of this? Well, a hurricane wipes out New Orleans. It's on your mind. It's fresh in your mind. You think, oh, it's much more likely to happen than before. The mechanism they thought they were describing, they call the availability heuristic. What happens, what is recalled easily to mind is distorts our judgment. Vivid things, things that happened recently, so on and so forth.
Danny Kahneman's nephew died in a tragic plane accident. His plane went sort of nose first into the ground and killed him. And that became also the source of some thinking. In fact, it's the Undoing Project. It's really about how people responded to this tragic accident.
This is what Danny and Amos were working on when they broke up. And Danny, in part because Danny thought he was working on it alone, and I found it, though I found in Amos's file cabinet, a big fat file called The Undoing Project, where he was, you know, kind of sadly noodling on the same problem. And what happened was Danny's nephew was two days away from getting out of the Israeli Air Force. And his co-pilot or his navigator were blinded by a flare. And apparently when you're going really fast in a jet, you can't really tell whether you're going up or down.
Wow.
And they thought they were going up and they were going down and they went boom. And Danny, being Danny, kind of distanced himself from the whole thing. And he watched the grief of the people around him. And he kept hearing the phrase, basically, if only.
If only.
If only he'd gotten out 2 days earlier. If only they hadn't shot that flare. And he started to think, being Danny, it's interesting because there's so many if onlys that would actually save this child's life, this young man's life, if only there wasn't an Israeli Air Force. But people's minds went to a few explanations. And he thought, this might be a way to explore the rules of the human imagination, how people imagine alternative realities. And thus was born the Undoing Project. And if you just think about it, we've gone through
this. We do it all the time, don't we?
How do you undo Trump?
Right.
If only Comey had not meddled. And what you do is you start at the end of the causal chain and you work backwards. And the first thing you can undo to change the outcome, you do. You don't think, if only Trump was born a girl. But there's a better than 50% chance that would have happened. And I assure you, if he was born a girl, he might have been huge, but I don't think he'd be president. And you think about, if you want to think about how this plays out, look at the way you watch the Eagles or
don't even go there.
No, let me tell you, I'm sure there's Eagles kickers all know that if they miss the field goal at the end of the game, they're going to get blamed for losing the game. But in fact, there are a million things that have happened in the game that would have made the field goal unimportant. But people undo. Bill Buckner can't live in Boston because a ground ball went through his legs at the end of a game. If it had gone through his ground ball through his legs in the beginning of a game with the same consequences, a run scores or whatever, no one would have remembered it.
And is this notion of if only, which of course we all do, is it this attempt to apply some degree of certainty and confidence in a really uncertain world that we know that we live in?
Yes. This is another broad description of their work, or a way of describing it. What they were doing was exploring the consequences of people's need for the world to be more certain than it actually is. And there are a great many consequences. When something happens that we didn't predict, we explain it. And the only additional information we have is the outcome. We had no idea it was going to happen, but after the fact, we can tell a coherent story about why it was going to happen. And all we know is, without any new information, this is people making the world a more deterministic place than it actually is. Because the mind does not live comfortably in a state of uncertainty.
Is it a form of superstition in a way?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I didn't think of it that way, but you could look at it that way. What they were busy teasing out is how the mind does this. You know, and they were always alive, constantly alive to the possibility of alternative outcomes. I mean, Amos, there was a line he just scribbled on a sheet of paper somewhere I saw that I thought was just lovely, captured it. He said, reality is not a point, it's a cloud of possibilities. At any given moment, there are all these other realities. It could have, you know, sometimes much more probable than the reality we have. And people don't like to move through the world in that state of mind. They like to move through the world thinking that it's knowable. And then one of the consequences of this is that we turn to, for expertise, people who exhibit way too much confidence about things that are inherently uncertain. We like excessive confidence in our doctors, our financial advisors, our lawyers, our presidents.
I was saying our presidents as well.
And in fact, the intelligent thing, if we really wanted to create an environment where they could stay sane, we would all acknowledge that the best you can do is have a really good decision-making process. There, you can't control a lot of outcomes. And you can acknowledge to us that there is some uncertainty. There's a 90% chance this will work, but there's a 10% chance it won't. We don't want to hear that. We want leadership, we think, is saying, I know, and this is the way to go. Follow me. And when I hear that now, I mean, I've always felt this way, but especially knowing what Danny and Amos had to say, I want to run the other direction when someone comes at me with this kind of overconfidence. If your financial advisor says he knows which way the stock market's going or really confident you should buy this stock, run, you know, because he shouldn't be.
Well, that, of course, leads to the inevitable question, which is Kahneman's still alive. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tversky died a couple of decades ago. What they would have said about the 2016 presidential campaign.
You know, it's fun to filter. I didn't write this book with Trump in mind, but it's fun to filter the election through Danny and Amos's sensibility.
Right.
They would have done several things. They would have played the undoing game with it. They would have watched the way people
think. The what-if thing.
How people did it. And why, and it would explore why they thought, you know, why they focused on this as opposed to that. They would have said that Trump was extremely good at preying on the weaknesses in the mind they'd identified. It's what, you know, it's why the you know, when he's always and forever exploiting the mind's natural tendency to think in stereotypes. Which is one of the they show how thinking in stereotypes warps judgments about people. They show it in a way that there is a right answer and a wrong answer, and you get the wrong answer because you're thinking in a stereotype about a person. This is what Moneyball was.
People, sure.
You know, the
sure.
Scouts saw what looked like a good baseball player, and they said, "Oh, he's a good baseball player." I mean, if he had something physically wrong with you, but you were actually good, they didn't see it. You didn't match the stereotype. And Trump plays on stereotypes and reinforces them.
Is that fear-based? I mean, did they also look at things like that?
Well, they didn't. They didn't. Weren't thinking so much of emotion about emotion, but they did show this the power. We make these similarity judgments as we move through life, and our mind is a classifying machine. And if you create crude classifications for people, they will, I mean, it will warp their judgment. They would have been, terrified about his overconfidence, his sense of his own infallibility, because their work is all about how, you know, if you were actually, you know, aware of your own mind and know your own mind, you're aware of the fallibilities. And he resists it. I think there's a passage in the book where Danny is exploring in a speech the consequences of their work, and he says, isn't it terrifying to think that the mind of some guy in office, and now that with what we know about that mind, this person now has their finger on a button and has the ability to annihilate life on Earth. I mean, I think they would have looked at Trump and said, oh my God, here we are.
You interviewed President Obama. Did I read that correctly?
More than that. I spent a lot of time with him. I wrote a piece about him 4 years ago for Vanity Fair.
Well, he told you, and perhaps I'm quoting from this, that he wears just two colors of suits because he was afraid of something called decision fatigue.
Well,
that if he had maybe a dozen choices.
So Danny and Amos, one of their insights, many insights, is that the decisions people make are greatly affected by the environments in which they make the decision. And you can change, you can get people to flip their decisions just by describing it differently. You can get someone to not have an operation that would save their life. Right. Save their life if you say there's a 10% chance of dying on the operating table, as opposed to saying there's a 90% chance you're going to survive it. You can get doctors to change their decision about whether to do the operation.
Just
framing it in a different way. And so when you think more broadly about this in your life when you're making decisions, what's around you and the mood you're in has a big effect on the decisions you make. And Obama was keenly aware of all this and their research. In fact, Danny's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, was on Air Force One's desk when I walked on into the
no,
Air Force.
No, really?
Yes, yep. And
the stars aligned, right?
Yeah. And Yes. And Bill James's letters were in Amos's file cabinets when I went to go research Amos. I mean, all these things match up. So Obama said, among other things, the more decisions you make, the weaker your decision-making powers. It's why when you walk into Costco and try to buy a few things, you walk out absolutely exhausted and with 700 sticky buns.
Exactly.
And so one of the ways Obama dealt with that is by eliminating all decisions that were not absolutely necessary. What he eats, what he wears. So we got rid of everything but the blue and the gray suits.
Wow.
And so he didn't have to think about it. I mean, the natural question is, why didn't you get rid of everything but just the gray suits? But I didn't.
You need a little bit of choice
in
life. I
didn't ask the follow-up. I was so interested in just the answer. But
you referenced this earlier, that doing this book and understanding the work of these two psychologists got you thinking about how you make decisions. Do you feel like you have just much more insight about the pitfalls of some of the decisions you might make? Do you have more clarity about how you maybe are correct or wrong when it comes to decision making?
So I don't actually make mistakes. No, I'm kidding.
You wouldn't be the first guest who has said that, but that's okay.
There are two answers to this. The first is Danny Namus said, look, what we're describing are these cognitive illusions. They are very like optical illusions. The mind, things are going on in the mind that there's a real analogy with the eye, with the ear, that, and when you study those mechanisms, the way you study it is by the errors it makes. And we're studying the mind the same way. Like an optical illusion, as when you point out an optical illusion to someone who is experiencing it, the illusion doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Right? You still see the water on the highway in the middle of the desert. You just know at some level that it's not water on the highway. You don't eliminate the cognitive illusion by pointing it out. And they became very fatalistic about people's ability to correct themselves.
Hold on to that thought, only because we need to take a very short break. Talking with Michael Lewis, his book is called The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. And we're here at Hamilton Media Commons at WHYY with a sold-out room of supporters and donors at WHYY. We'll be right back.
Yes, we had to take some losses in our subprime department last year, but those losses will be contained at only 5%. Now, in our residential sector...
I have a question, please.
Sir, the Q&A is after my statements, but you know what? You seem anxious.
Thank you.
How can I help you?
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Would you say that it is a possibility or a probability that subprime losses stop at 5%? Thank you.
I would say it is a very strong probability, indeed. So, back to the residential sector. When we rolled out the new variable rates package...
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Zero. Zero. There is a 0% chance that your subprime losses will stop at 5%. Zero. Excuse me. I have to take this.
He must be from Bank of America.
That, of course, is seen from The Big Short. Steve Carell plays money manager Mark Baum, interrupting a lecture intended to calm the fears about subprime losses. Puts me a little bit of a PTSD, even just listening to that. The movie is based on the best-selling book by our guest, Michael Lewis, and we're talking about his new book called The Undoing Project, again about the groundbreaking work of two Israeli psychologists, Daniel Kahneman, Amos Tversky. They revolutionized our understanding of the pitfalls of decision-making. This is a special edition of Radio Times broadcast out of WHYY's Hamilton Media Commons with a house full of WHYY donors and supporters. So much I want to ask you, and I have questions from the audience as well, but I'm interested in the decision-making answer to the question I asked you right before the break. For yourself, do you feel like you think more clearly about the decisions that you make, or the pitfall still there?
I feel like I think a lot more clearly about other people's decisions.
There you go.
That's the punchline to you don't really see your own cognitive illusions. And I feel like I have a heightened appreciation of my own fallibility, and that the way to deal with it is not by becoming, you know, twisted up in a knot of self-doubt, which is what Danny's response to his understanding of the human condition was. Because I just don't move through life that way. I mean, I think everything's going to work out, and I think I'm going to get the parking spot every time, you know. And it's fun to move through life that way, kind of optimistically about oneself and others. But what you can do if you're benighted as I am is create an environment where you have checks. So listen more carefully to what other people are saying about your decisions. And this is what Amy, you know, when. For example, this is one of about 6 billion examples, but the world in the 1970s and 80s woke up, individuals woke up to the importance of these guys' work in medicine, in law, in sports a little bit, and they got all these calls, like, what do we do to make our decision-making better? And Danny's response is often, you can't do anything. But Amos said, Delta Airlines called Amos. So we got a problem. The head guy ran Delta Airlines' pilot training program. He trained 6,000 Delta Airlines pilots. He said, we've had a lot of weird instances recently where pilots were making judgmental errors in the cockpit. They were landing in Miami when they were supposed to be going to Fort Lauderdale, that kind of thing.
Wow.
I mean, and they didn't understand. There was a streak. And they were non-fatal, but they thought sooner or later this is going to be fatal. And we don't quite understand what's going on. They brought in Amos for hours. That's all it took. And Amos said, the problem is the culture of the cockpit, that the captain is an autocrat, and he's unquestioned, and nobody speaks up. And if you change the culture of the cockpit, where everybody else in there can at least, he can't see his cognitive, his judgmental error, but you can. The other people in there might see it for him. They have to be encouraged to speak up. The guy who ran the training program, who I got on the phone, he said, it's funny you call me. He said, I saw you, Mr. Tversky, one afternoon, 25 years ago, and he changed the way we trained pilots, and everybody emulated us. He said pilots are trained differently in America today, and the cockpits are different because of the conversation I had with Amos Tversky. And it was just like with a flick of the wrist, he gave a piece of advice that you can actually, you know, you change the culture of your own life's cockpit so that you let in those voices.
That's democracy, isn't it? I mean, the people have a voice.
That's checks and balances.
Checks and balances,
In your own judgment. Yeah, so that's how, to the extent I've tried to adapt a little bit to what I've come to understand with researching these guys. Now, I say all this very blithely sitting on stage at a radio show in Philadelphia. My wife back in California would be saying, yeah, change it all. But she just doesn't know.
And we won't tell her. Let me read a couple of questions that we have from our audience here. What would Kahneman and Tversky's work say about the proliferation of fake news stories that had such a large impact on people's decision-making process during the recent presidential election? And there's been a lot of talk about the fact that there were these fake news stories that many people believed. A guy believed that Hillary Clinton and John Podesta were running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. A guy comes up there with a gun to check it out. What do you make of that?
Well,
and what are these two?
If you want to filter it through Danny and Amos, which I think the easiest way is the way people make sense of the world is with stories. They're telling themselves a story. And sometimes it's hard to change that story. Once you start a narrative, it follows a certain it gathers its own momentum. And I think it was their phrase, confirmation bias.
Absolutely.
And anyway, someone attributed to them, or they got from their work, the idea of confirmation bias. And that's just, you are looking for information to confirm what's going on in your story.
Which you believe anyway.
Yeah, which you believe anyway. So we've got some meaningful number of Americans who got this very weird story running in their heads. I don't think it's as many. It's certainly not as many as who voted for Trump. It's not like every Trump voter, I think, is a victim of fake news. I think that's another. That's an example of the other side misunderstanding what's going on in the Trump movement. But there's enough of it. It's kind of terrifying, and which changed is the technology, right? The ability to deliver fake news to these factoids that confirm what people, these weird stories people have playing out in their heads to them. So that's the response of the social media companies now to start to get very concerned about what they're disseminating is the right one. I mean, absolutely the right one. They need the same sort of editorial discipline that the New York Times has. And I think that's probably what's going to happen.
Given the overall uncertainty in the market today, what investment advice can you share with us? These are the questions that will haunt you forever, Michael Lewis.
No, I've gotten that question. It was amazing to me after I wrote Liar's Poker, where I showed just my astonishing capacity to lose other people's money.
Right, exactly.
The first question everybody wanted was, what should I do with my money? Now, that tells you something about yourself.
Right.
That you're asking for advice you shouldn't be asking for. From people you shouldn't be asking for it from. So
and
watch
yet
that.
We ask,
so
right?
That's the first thing I would say, is go to a meta level and say, first, should I even be asking for the advice? Second, what do I want in the person giving me the advice? And I don't want really simple, clear answers about what to buy, because there aren't any. Now, what I will tell you, I'll tell you instead of what advising, giving you specific financial advice, I'll tell you what I do with my money. I don't think about it. I don't spend my life.
Is that hard?
No. I mean, it's just, I don't financialize my life. I'd rather live my life. And so I make very broad decisions, and then I don't look at it. So the broad decisions are how much is in the stock market, how much is in cash, and how much is in, like, municipal bonds. And that decision is pretty conservative. I just try not to lose too much. And the stuff in the stock market, I put in index funds, low-cost Vanguard index funds. Or I give to Warren Buffett. If I'm feeling really like if it's a day when I really want to kind of really juice up my life, really jazz it up, I buy some Berkshire Hathaway. And that's it. And that's it. And then I don't think about it. I'm in a quandary now. The only financial quandary I have right now is that this buffoon has been elected president, and he's going to do a lot of damage to our country, I think, but maybe not. But one of the byproducts of this is he's made me a lot richer. The stock market's going way up, and my taxes are going to go down. And I'm trying in my mind create a mental account where I put the money that I benefit from, that I get from the Trump presidency, and put it in things to help defend people who can't defend themselves against Trump. And so that's the my finance. To people of means, I'd say create that mental account and say, is it a defense fund for Mexican immigrants? Is it Planned Parenthood? Whatever it is, but something that is going to actually kind of create a pushback. And don't think of it as your money. Think about it like, I shouldn't have this money.
We played a clip from the Big Short, of course, based on your book. And the inevitable question is, are we back to our bad old ways? And will we have another version of the subprime mortgage crisis and go down the tubes again? Do you know? Can you tell?
No, of course not. I don't know. Nobody knows. And anybody tells you they know, they don't know. I don't think of it like, where's the financial crisis going to happen? If you knew, it wouldn't happen. What I do think of instead is, what are the incentives in the financial system? Because that's what led us astray. It was a big problem that people in big Wall Street banks were incentivized to create bad loans. I mean, that's the opposite of what the financial sector is supposed to do. It's supposed to assess risk, price it accurately, and then let the markets do with it. If it's hiding risk and assessing it inaccurately, intentionally, it creates a disaster. And it will do that if people are paid to do that. That's the great lesson of the financial crisis, is people will do what they're paid to do on Wall Street, no matter what it is.
It was legal, what they were doing? Because the question has been asked, why did no one go to jail?
Yeah. The problem is, the vast majority is legal. I'm sure you could, if you dug down, if you worked really hard, you might find some illegality, but that wasn't the problem. You wouldn't have eliminated the crisis by eliminating the illegal behavior. If you roll back Dodd-Frank and regulations, what incentives are you going to bake back into the system that we try to get out of the system? And you have to, the devil's in the details here. But the noise of the incoming administration that there's too much regulation in the financial sector, it may be true that there's some regulations we should just do away with. I'm willing to believe that, but you got to be very careful about what they are.
Wow. Let me go back to these two psychologists. You write that they didn't believe in God. I think I have that correct. Does that help us understand their thinking about decision-making and the undoing project and confirmation bias?
I think it, so God is a deterministic kind of thing,
yes.
Right? So their ability to live in this state of in a probabilistic state, I think is related to the impulse not to believe in God. Yeah. They're both in a very curious religious position. Both of them had very, very famous rabbis as grandfathers. World famous rabbis as grandfathers. Both of them had fathers who had walked away from their father's religion, who were comic darkly, like Russian novel dark comedy. I think it informed their sensibility. They're close to religion. You can't be in Israel and be, but they aren't themselves religious. And when you're in that situation, you're different from just a sterile atheist. What happens is you all of a sudden start to see lots of irony. And they were both ironists, I think.
It sounds very Talmudic in a way. I mean, their arguments perhaps with each other and ideas.
What it was smart.
Was smart.
Yeah, I mean, their minds were. Here's what I wanted people to get from the book. And, you know, it took me a while to figure out why I was writing the book. The ideas are all great, right? They're really interesting, but you can go read the research papers. I wanted to bring them to life on the page so that after you read the book, they're with you for the rest of your life, because it's actually them. Mm-hmm. It's actually their minds. You want to have an idea of Danny's response to the world and an idea of Amos's response to the world in your mind when you yourself are making judgments. You kind of want to ask, what would they say about this? Like you just asked me about Trump.
Right.
And you get to interesting places when you do that, once you have a model of them in your mind. So that was that's the point. It's them. You know, they're what's special.
Well, and not to give the end away, as you say, this really was a love story in many ways, and like many love stories, has a sad ending.
Is that true in your life?
I'm not dying yet.
My love stories all have had happy endings.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
I'm,
no, you know
they
what
haven't,
I mean.
Actually. You're right, and but it is. As Barbara Tversky, Amos's wife, said, their relationship was much more intense than a marriage. And fortuitously for me, Amos kept all the love letters and the breakup letters. And he kept everything, including the notes he scratched to himself that said preparation for phone call with Danny, where he made the list of the things Danny was going to be upset about and how he was going to respond. It was fraught. And that Amos Tversky, who was famous among other things for not doing anything he didn't want to do, not a thing, wouldn't lift a finger if he didn't want to do it, endured this traumatic love affair, tells you how valuable it was.
We're almost out of time here. You told me before going on the air that part of what happens on a book tour is by the time you get to the end of it, you hate what you have written. And I'm glad you're with us in the beginning of your book tour, not the end. But is that a way of just severing your relationship with what you've written and opening up new possibilities? We're
so
almost out of time here.
I've always found it odd that politicians, the more they say something, the more they believe it. Because I think normal, sane people, the more they say it, the more they doubt it. It sounds rote.
Yep.
And you're forced to say the same thing over and over on a book tour, so you start to think, wow, I just told a lie.
Well, on that note, thank you, Michael Lewis.
Thank you very much
for joining us. And his new book is called The Undoing Project. Also, special thanks to our audience today, donors and supporters of WHYY. We appreciate that. Thanks also to Brittany Smith for all her help organizing this special event. And today's engineers, Kevin Griffin, Adam Staniszewski, and Bob Alls. Radio Times producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.